Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, February 22, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing various aspects of criminal prosecution at the federal level and prosecutorial discretion. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that we're recording this call for possible use as a podcast in the future. We have three experts joining us today, and we'll hear opening remarks from each of our three experts in turn of about 5 to 8 minutes. That'll be followed by an exchange between the experts, followed by your questions, so please be giving some thought to questions you might ask of any of our experts at the conclusion of the first round. I also want to let you know that we're told here at the Federal Society headquarters that there are some infrastructure problems with our building, and we could, without warning, lose power. We've tried to do a backup system for this call, so hopefully the call will not be interrupted, but there's at least some possibility that the call could somewhat precipitously be dropped, and if that happens, I apologize in advance. Back to today's call. We'll hear first from Mr. Conrad Black. He's a financier and the author of several notable biographies and his own recent personal memoir, A Matter of Principle. His opening remarks will be followed by Professor Ellen Podgor. She's a professor at Stetson University College of Law. She's a former deputy prosecutor and criminal defense attorney, and she teaches at Stetson in the areas of white-collar crime, criminal law, and international criminal law. And we'll hear third from Mr. Bill Otis. He is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a graduate of Stanford Law School and a former federal prosecutor himself. Their longer bios are available on our website, as always, and I want to get right to the discussion. So with that, Mr. Black, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you very much, Dean Reuter. It is, in fact, the real beginning now, right? You expect me to speak now?
Yes, please go right ahead.
Okay, thanks very much. I'm honored to be on this panel, and I don't know that everyone would concede that I'm an expert in the way that obviously the other two panelists are, but I have unfortunately had a most prolonged and regrettable brush with the American criminal justice system. I'm not a U.S. citizen or resident, but I would, on the basis of my experiences, express very severe concerns about how the criminal justice system functions in the United States. And my own background is that technically I am legally qualified, but that was in Quebec many years ago in essentially a civil law system. And I would take great pity on anyone who relied upon my legal advice to govern their own conduct, and I'm not active in the profession. My concerns are based on what I think has been a very severe contortion of the original concept entrenched in the Bill of Rights and elsewhere in texts that would be familiar to all members, I'm sure, of the Federalist Society. And I can state it succinctly in a summary that, as I'm sure most of you know, the United States criminal justice system produces guilty findings in 97% of prosecutions by plea bargains. 97% are settled without a trial. And of those that are tried, 2.5 of the remaining 3% result in guilty findings. So you have a 99.5% conviction rate. And this is not seriously comparable to other countries. And prosecutors are generally well qualified in civilized countries, but they don't normally have that kind of a success rate, and their judgment is not as good as that. In Canada and Britain, countries that I know and have been a citizen of, the corresponding numbers are about 60% success rate in Canada and a little less than that in Britain, and they're good legal systems, and they're seriously law-abiding countries with a distinguished legal tradition. The United States has 6 to 12 times as many incarcerated people as Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Japan, and the United Kingdom, which I would submit are as close as you get to comparable countries, prosperous, sophisticated democracies, all of them, and as the United States is. And the plea bargain system as it has evolved in the United States is subject to terrible abuse, and I think that anyone vested with the powers that in practice American prosecutors now have, where they are virtually immune to review and have in effect an, an absolute immunity, as was illustrated in the Thompson case a few years ago, where it emerged that somebody had been on death row for 14 years, but prosecutors had deliberately suppressed DNA evidence that would exculpate him. But eventually it emerged, and the Supreme Court of the United States ruled 5-4 that the prosecutors could not be pursued legally, that if discipline was to be taken, disciplinary action, it should be taken by the bars of the prosecutors concerned. And it is the nature of people that when they're armed with such power as that and also backed so heavily as they are by the natural bias of society in favor of what is broadly called law and order, they're apt to abuse that power, and in my opinion, it is very terribly abused, and I've seen it abused, and I've been a victim of its abuse, although I've had greater ability to defend myself than most people do. As most of the people on the call would know, and certainly the other panelists would, it is a frequent recourse to declare that the means by which targeted people are going to defend themselves are from ill-gotten gains, and those means are frozen and are therefore not available for the defense. I had to go through that, but fortunately most of my assets weren't in the United States, and when overtures were made to the Canadian and British authorities, they advised the U.S. Justice Department to try and seek to gain a freeze in open court, and don't imagine that it would be granted as a result of the operation of the mutual legal assistance treaties with those countries. So I was able to mount a defense, but it was in general a very successful defense since the charges were in fact unfounded, but that did not prevent me from a sojourn in your federal prison system, which is no day at the beach, believe me, despite what people say about country clubs, although no one bothered me personally. But there are, and it's not a well-publicized fact, approximately 48 million people in the United States today with criminal records. Now, admittedly, a very large number of those are not stigmatizing or bothersome to them now. They would be things like driving under the influence 20 years ago or being disorderly at a university fraternity party or something like that. But tens of millions of them are unnecessarily destructive to the subsequent lives of the people involved. It is a rule of thumb that the United States has 5% of the world's population, 25% of its incarcerated people, and 50% of the lawyers in the world who are seriously academically qualified, not self-improvised lawyers such as one finds in places like India. I put it to you, to all of you, that the Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendment rights of due process, the grand jury as an assurance against capricious prosecution, the bar on seizure of property without just compensation, access to counsel of choice, access to counsel, which courts have interpreted as counsel of choice, and prompt justice, an impartial jury, and reasonable bail, do not really seriously exist. I was posting $38 million in bail. That was not reasonable. I've been harassed by the U.S. justice system for 9 years. We're at the end of it now, but it was a completely unreasonable length of time and abusive charges, but I'll leave my own particular travails out of it. And the grand jury is, in most jurisdictions, as everybody knows, a rubber stamp. It'll do whatever prosecutors ask. And the procedural rules are not a level playing field at all. The prosecutors speak last, unlike other countries, to the jurors. Jurors generally have to rely on their memories for things, no matter how lengthy and complicated the trial. And the rules of evidence and access to witnesses is quite uneven, and the deadlines for matters of documentation are uneven and frequently unreasonable. And the plea bargain, as everybody, I think, informed on the subject knows, operates in a way that consists of the prosecutors extorting inculpatory evidence, interviewing witnesses, requiring catechetical responses until a bar is reached that justifies granting them an immunity, including an immunity from charges for perjury, in exchange for inculpating testimony. That's what we had. We demolished all of the witnesses, and the jurors said in post-trial comments they didn't believe a word they said, nor should they have. They all lied because they all came in with rods on their backs. And that is not justice. And in Canada or Britain, and I do not hold those systems to be above criticism or unimpeachable by any means, but prosecutors would be disbarred for that, and they should be. So I will subside now, Dean. I think I've spoken my time. But I look forward to elaborating on these points if anyone wishes me to. But I think that there is a terrible problem in the U.S. There are approximately 2.5 million people in prison. A large number of them are not mentally competent. A very significant number are completely innocent. The sentences are too severe. The system is bedeviled by private sector companies that are always agitating, along with the very politically active and astute correctional officers' unions, for more designated crimes and longer sentences. Prisons are overcrowded, too expensive, and the system is, in fact, a terrible mess. And yet 90% of Americans probably believe it's the best justice system in the world. And I tell you, it isn't. It is not very good. Thank you.
Professor Ellen Podgor.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here. And I will start by saying I agree with a lot of what Mr. Black has just stated. I think there are some significant problems in the United States system. I would say that looking at it from a global perspective, there are many, many systems that are worse. And our democratic system does offer a lot of benefits. But we do have some problems within that system, and they need to be rectified. And he's quite right about that. The first thing that I notice is that prosecutors have enormous discretion in the criminal justice system. They decide who to proceed with a prosecution. They select the charges. They select the individuals who are going to get accused of the crimes. And they get to use that discretion how they so please, and are only really bound by the legislation that is very much of an outer boundary, and they still have an enormous discretion within that legislation. What makes it different today from what it was in the past is that we now have so many choices for prosecutors. We have over 4,500 federal statutes. We have administrative regulations. And this vast number of overcriminalization provides prosecutors with many choices that they didn't used to have. One only needs to look at the Without Intent report that was done by NACDL and the Heritage Foundation to see the problems that have accrued within the system because of the fact that intent is no longer a significant factor in so much of the legislation that's been passed. Another major problem that we've had is it used to be, for example, in white-collar cases or difficult types of cases, that prosecutors used to use tax offenses. Now what they have are statutes like RICO, or they have shortcuts. They can go with charges like obstruction of justice, perjury, or false statements, and they never even have to prove the entire underlying fraud, if there is any fraud there in the first place. They have terms like honest services within a statute now, and unfortunately the Supreme Court did not just eliminate the term honest services. They, as one of the dissenting justices says, they invented an interpretation to it by allowing kickbacks or bribery. The plea bargaining system is also a problem, and I agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Black on this point. The stakes are high. The risk is even higher for a defendant. When faced with the possibility of a long prison term and a shorter plea bargain, many can't afford to take the risk. If they have families, if they have a life that they want to lead, that risk factor is too great for them to take it. Prosecutors also have the ability of a 5K1.1. Now, as a result of recent Supreme Court decisions like Booker, Blakely, Gall, and Rita, the judiciary has now gotten a little bit more power back, but it's still the prosecutors who have that ability to reduce it and go outside the guideline system. The prosecutors do have their U.S. Attorney's Manual, and I hear it too many times when legislation is being proposed, don't worry about us because we have our manual and we will control the things that might come up. But the problem is that manual is strictly internal. It has no force of law. And I think it's incumbent upon Congress to take a look at that and be more restrictive in the legislation that they're passing. The huge increase in sentences, especially in the white-collar area, is another flaw within the system. And that's one of the things that puts so many people in that risk determination that they're willing to take the plea agreement. There are also huge collateral consequences, the right to vote, the right, if you're in a defense procurement case, to do business with the government, the right to get a job in the future. All of these things play a factor. And there's one more factor that I think is really important and that it's important for everybody to understand. The prosecutorial power, especially in white-collar cases, can exceed for a very long period of time. These are not overnight investigations. These are not investigations where a person is charged with a crime a day or two after the crime allegedly is committed. These are cases where a grand jury may be investigating for one, two, a long period of time in years. What this does to an individual, what this does to their family, the psychological devastation that this causes is something that needs to be looked at. Thank you very much, and let me pass it on to Bill.
Well, thank you very much. I feel privileged to be on a panel with two such distinguished people. I was a federal prosecutor and assistant U.S. attorney for 18 years, and I promise you from personal experience that prosecutors are nowhere near as powerful or as nasty as they are sometimes portrayed. Prosecutors don't convict, and they don't sentence. Juries convict, and judges sentence. It's true that most cases now are resolved by plea bargains, but this fact remains. Any felony defendant who wants a jury trial can get one, no questions asked. 12 impartial citizens who presume him innocent stand between him and jail. The reason so many cases are resolved by plea bargains is simple, and it's not extortion. It's this. The defendant is guilty. The government can prove it. He knows the government can prove it. And he can get a better deal by bargaining than by going to a trial at which the whole bloody mess will get spilled out in front of an increasingly appalled judge and jury. The 99.5% of defendants are convicted does not, contrary to Mr. Black's National Review article, suggest a, quote, totalitarian system. To the exact contrary, they showed the prosecutors select for indictment people who are actually guilty, which is what they ought to do. If there were a higher percentage of not guilty verdicts, the claim would just be spun in the opposite direction. It would be that the system has become a dragnet that forces legions of the innocent to bear the cost and stigma of a criminal accusation only to be exonerated. The claim that America is vastly over-incarcerated, or, in quote, incarceration nation, as it's often called, is not correct. We have a population of 315 million, of which approximately two and three-quarter million are incarcerated in federal and state prisons and local and county jails. In other words, 0.75% of the population is incarcerated. 99.25% isn't. Whatever else this may be, incarceration nation it is not. The claim of over-incarceration is mistaken not just for its significant exaggeration, but because it whistles past two enormously important facts. One I have mentioned, that the path to jail runs through the jury room whenever that's what the accused demands. The other is that, unlike the impression you may have been given, prosecutors are in fact accountable and not just to the jury and the judge. Unlike the aristocracy, the so-called prosecutocracy is part of the elected branches of government. Federal prosecutors are appointed, that's true, but the vast majority of prosecutors who operate at the state and local level are voted in. That means they can be voted out. Their accountability is one election away. The reason that prosecutors aren't nearly as unpopular with the electorate as they are with, say, defense lawyers, is that prosecutors have been a central part of something else that hasn't been mentioned today, and that is the massive decrease in crime in the last generation. Crime rates have fallen by over 50%. Prosecution and imprisonment are certainly not the sole reason for this fact, that we're so much safer than we were 20 years ago, but they're a big part of the reason. This is confirmed not just by studies, but by common sense. When you lock up the people who commit crime, you get less crime. I might add that the criminal justice system's success in reducing crime means not just that it's not broken, which is what we so often hear, but that it is, quite to the contrary, probably the most successful social policy of its time. By contrast, the massively greater spending we have on welfare and entitlement programs has brought us the largest number of people living below the poverty line since the poverty line was invented. What the talk of constraining prosecutors overlooks is trade-offs. What you gain in piling constraints on the prosecutor, you lose in increasing the risk that the guilty will beat the rap and go forth to do it again. For example, we can certainly put a dent in the prosecutor's conviction rate if we require a unanimous jury of 50 people instead of 12. But what this will mean is that even more factually guilty people will beat the rap than do so at present. And what that means is that there will be more innocent crime victims, victims who deserve the law's protection certainly no less than their victimizers. I want to take note, finally, of several of the assertions in Mr. Black's article on the prosecutocracy. That's the article that appeared in National Review. The article states, and I'm quoting now, and this goes back to something that he said earlier in our call, even leaving out the 15% or so of accused who are completely innocent and the 50% or more of the rest who would not be convicted or not so effortlessly if real due process obtained, the sentences are extreme and sentencing has been wrenched from the hands of judges and usurped by legislators, end quote. Now, I was not able to find in the article any sources for those eye-popping figures. I did look just last night on the site of the Innocence Project, a group that is no friend of wide-ranging prosecutorial discretion. In the frequently asked questions part of the Innocence Group site, it says, and I quote, "The few studies that have been done estimate that between 2.3% and 5% of all prisoners in the U.S. are innocent," end quote. That's nothing like the 15% that Mr. Black stated in the article. The view that at least 50% of the others, the guilty, would not be convicted if we had, quote, real due process, unquote, reveals what is, to my way of thinking, a bizarre view of due process. If half of factually guilty people could not be convicted for what they have done under the model of due process that Mr. Black would prefer, then that model should be rejected. Process that is truly due reliably convicts factually guilty people. It does not let half of them off. Finally, legislators did not and do not wrench sentencing from the hands of judges. When crime spiked in the 60s and 70s, legislatures wisely, and as we have seen, effectively, tipped the balance away from unbridled judicial discretion to a more rules-oriented system. This introduction of the rule of law into sentencing was long overdue in its own right, is certainly authorized by the Constitution, and, as I noted, has helped produce a far safer country than what we had a couple of generations ago. Okay, thank you very much. Over to you, Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Otis.
and thank you to the audience for your patience. Let me, since a lot has been said since his opening remarks, give a minute or two just to Mr. Black, if we could, and then a minute or two to Professor Podgor, and then a very brief rebuttal from Mr. Bill Otis. But first, Mr. Black.
Thanks very much, Dean, and thank you to the other panelists for your comments, too. Professor Podgor, I mean, as far as I can see, almost complete agreement with. I certainly took no issue with anything that she said. Mr. Otis has given us, I must say, a commendably comprehensive and unabashed whitewash of a system that is, in fact, I hate to tell you this, Mr. Otis, but from my own observations, which are very extensive, in many ways an evil system. It is, as I described it, it does a terrible, unconscionable amount of human damage in your country, and it ruins unnecessarily the lives of a large number of people. Yes, of course, 0.75% does not seem like a great many people to have in prison at any one time, but that assertion flies in the face of the fact that the figure is, as I said, 6 to 12 times the per capita average of other advanced comparable societies that, in fact, have lower crime rates in the United States. The lower crime rate in the United States has almost nothing to do with throwing more people in prison. The fact of more people in prison is largely from the sadistic implementation of this insane war on drugs in a very uneven way, where the authorities troll through poor African-American districts, rounding up street dealers and ignore the real sources of most of the demand. And do not, the United States, though it is the greatest military power in the world, does not really control the access through its own borders of drug importers, but relies upon other countries to reduce themselves to a state of civil war to prevent the drugs getting to the U.S. border. The fact is that that almost every one of the assertions that you made is inaccurate. You do not dispute that 48 million Americans have a criminal record. That isn't 0.75% of the country. It's 16% of the people in the country. 16% of Americans aren't criminals, and it's an outrageous and a fascistic figure. Yes, it is a prosecutocracy, and the theory that if there's any restraint in the prosecutors at all is absolute rubbish. They do what they want, and they're not accountable to anyone. The ones who are elected are accountable to the voters, who can be whipped up rather easily with the assistance of morons like Nancy Grace on the issue of law and order. But the fact is, I thought that when they took down Scooter Libby, the chief of staff of the vice president, on no evidence at all, and then sandbagged poor old Senator Ted Stevens, both of whom I know or knew in Senator Stevens' case, fine Americans, patriotic public servants, absolutely false convictions, that possibly somebody would get the idea in Washington that it was time to restrain prosecutors a little. No such thing has happened, as far as I can see. I think I'm in danger of running over the time allotted to me by the dean, so I shall stop now. But I would just make one point. It is not the case that the practice of throwing more and more people in prison is related in anything other than the most marginal way to the decline in the crime rate. That is the aging of the population, improved police techniques, and a profusion of security cameras. And the answer is not simply to steadily lengthen out sentences and provide more and more criminal offenses, as Professor Podgor said, 4,500 of them now, including these catchments that can throw anyone in prison. And as for your theory that people have the assurance of a jury trial, that is an absolute farce. As you know, they're kangaroo courts, and if they weren't, you wouldn't get 99.5% conviction rates. Thanks, Dean.
Yes, sir. Professor Podgor.
Yes, I have a great respect for our jury system. I think it works extremely well in many cases, and I think we should take pride in our jury system. But I also think that what you've said, Mr. Otis, is not quite accurate, and that is that you think of the jury system as a check upon the system of our justice, and that's where it fails. The jury only gets to see what the prosecutors want it to see. They get to select the indictment. You can't tell me that the grand jury really selects it. So they're the ones who are getting to decide what evidence is going to be presented, what charges are going to be presented. They may limit it only to a shortcut offense like a false statement. We're merely making a no statement, an exculpatory no statement to a federal officer becomes a crime in the United States. It may be a perjury. It may be an obstruction of justice. These simplistic type crimes that prosecutors can charge so that they don't have to go through the entire fraud that they think might exist. The other power that prosecutors have that really discredits the fact that the jury serves as a check on the system is prosecutors have that immunity power. There is so few cases out there where defense have been given the right of defense use immunity. It's the prosecutors that get to decide who gets charged, who is not going to be charged, who is going to be a cooperating witness, who is going to get the benefit of the cooperating witness, and who is going to talk for the government, whether it's truthful or not. The third thing I would say with regard to a check on the jury system, it's only as good a check when there is complete and open discovery. And that, unfortunately, is a problem in the United States right now. We do not have prosecutors in many jurisdictions turning over their entire file to the defense so that we can be on an equal playing field. And we've seen too many discovery violations that are a corruption to our system. So to say that the jury is a check on the system, I have to disagree with you. And I am a supporter of our jury system.
Mr. Bill Otis, your response, and why don't you take a couple minutes since this seems we're ending up two on one here, but go right ahead.
That's okay. I'm used to it. More than that, actually. Thank you for the opportunity. Let me start with Mr. Black's statement that what the criminal justice system really does is just create a tremendous amount of damage and heartache and ruined lives. With all respect, I believe exactly the opposite is true. It's the criminal justice system that has helped facilitate this 50% reduction in crime that we've seen over the last generation. That means 50% fewer murder victims, rape victims, victims of aggravated assault, of burglary, of car theft. That's the kind of thing that will actually ruin a person's life, being the victim of a crime like that. That happens much less frequently now than it used to. It's true, as Mr. Black says, that more energetic prosecution and more incarceration is not the entire reason. He's right. He named three of the other reasons: more police, greater security, private security measures, and a changing demographic, a somewhat of a graying of the population. All those three things also contribute. But the idea that locking up criminals does not create less crime is just not so. There was a study out of the University of Chicago by a fellow named Steve Levitt, and that study was concurred in by James Q. Wilson, who's probably, until his recent death, America's most eminent criminologist, that at least a quarter of the reduction in crime over the last generation is due to increased prosecution and imprisonment. So I think that's just wrong. Now, Mr. Black also said that, yes, it may be true, contrary to what he said in this National Review article, that just a very low percentage of people in prison are actually innocent, and not the 15% he mentioned in that article. But that, as he also said in his opening statement, most of the people with criminal records have criminal records for smoking a joint, for DUI, for petty crimes, the kind of criminal record that really does not hamper them significantly in leading their lives. So I think that aspect of his presentation is not entirely correct. I guess the one other thing I want to talk about is Professor Podgore's thinking that the jury system is inadequate. In particular, her comment that the jury, and I believe this is a direct quotation, the jury sees only what the prosecutor wants it to see. That's not the Constitution that I read. The Constitution that I read and the actual practice in which I participated is that the jury sees what the prosecutor wanted to see, so long as it's within the rules of evidence, and also anything the defendant wants it to see, and the defense lawyer and the defense witnesses want it to see, again, so long as it's within the rule of evidence. Defendants in this country have a constitutional right, freely exercised, to put on the defense they want. And trial judges, in my experience, are quite liberal in letting the jury see not just what the prosecutor wants, but what the defendant wants. And Professor Podgore's contrary statement does not square with the actual practice of how trials get conducted, in my experience.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Otis. We've got quite a few people on the phone. I imagine they have some questions of their own, so let's go to the audience for their questions. In a moment, you should hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting for folks to ring in, let me make a very brief announcement of our schedule of calls in the future. Next week, we've got four calls scheduled so far. Monday at 2 p.m., we'll be talking about gun control in the wake of Newtown and sort of exploring some of the legal and constitutional limitations on gun control. That's Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. On Tuesday, we'll have a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum when John Elwood will attend oral argument of the Maryland versus King case and step out to report to our audience on what transpired at that oral argument. That's Tuesday. On Wednesday, again in the Courthouse Steps mode, Abigail Thernstrom and Hans von Spakovsky will attend oral argument in the Shelby County Voting Rights Act case and report to you on what transpired at oral argument there. And then finally on Thursday, American Express versus Italian Colors Restaurant will be the case being discussed by litigator Tom Hungar. So a very complete schedule. For details, check the Federalist Society website if you would. The schedule is subject to change. Looks like we've got at least three audience members lined up for now with questions. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Glenn Reynolds has an excellent blog article on this subject in which he points out that with current statutes and prosecutorial discretion, it is possible for any good prosecutor to find something on which to charge almost anybody, so that we have a situation not just of prosecutorial discretion being a problem, but of overcriminalization. But there, I have to disagree with Mr. Otis in that, in fact, the defense is not allowed to make the case that it wants before a jury. The original standard of due process was given us by Judge Cranch in Stettinius v. U.S., in which he presented the original standard of due process, which was that in mixed cases of law and fact, which includes all criminal cases, parties have the right to make all legal arguments to the jury, right up to the point where the judge issues his final instructions. Defense is not allowed to do that today. So the jury is not being informed that, for example, 95% of all federal criminal statutes are unconstitutional, and therefore everyone prosecuted under them is actually innocent because there is no law. Because
that sounds, let me interrupt you there, John. That sounds like a question for Bill Otis. We've got a number of callers lined up with questions. Let me see if he wants to respond to that, what you've said so far.
Yes, I would. With all respect to our caller, the proposition that 95% of federal criminal statutes are unconstitutional is not merely mistaken, it's preposterous. The courts have held no such thing. It's extremely rare for a court to hold that a federal criminal statute is unconstitutional. And if the point, if the caller's point that is that defendants ought to be able to argue something like that to the jury, well, he's right in a way. No, they shouldn't. I think that the word that he didn't use, but the point he's actually getting to, is the idea of jury nullification, that juries ought to be able to refuse to convict when they disagree with a statute. This most ordinarily comes up in the context of drug statutes, particularly with those who believe that marijuana or even the harder drugs should be illegal. But of course, that's not where nullification would end. Suppose, for example, a person believes that child prostitution is actually a consensual sort of thing. I mean, if you give the little girl a lollipop or a pretty pair of sneakers, I mean, she'll go along with it. And therefore, that defendant should be able to argue to the jury that the statute is unconstitutional. Suppose we have someone who's a jihadist or a radical Muslim who believes in honor killings, that killing your 16-year-old daughter because she holds hands with her 17-year-old boyfriend, see, that's needed to vindicate the honor of the family, and therefore killing her for that, well, you know, that's okay, and he should be able to argue that to the jury. I don't think so. I think defendants are properly constrained in their arguments to what settled law allows. The idea that each jury should be able to displace Congress and the legislature in deciding what the law will be would create not only an unconstitutional and lawless system, but essentially a vigilante system in which, for example, to put the shoe on the other foot, if a vigilante jury that could believe in nullifying the idea that the defendant's guilt has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, a vigilante jury could conclude that, well, you know, if we just kind of think the guy, the defendant is guilty and he looks like a nasty character, we'll convict him anyway. Allowing juries to make their own law is contrary to the whole idea of democratic self-government and rule of law by the legislature.
Professor Podgor or Mr. Black, do you want to weigh in on this point before we go to our next caller?
This is Ellen Podgor. I would just merely say that one thing I do want to point out is that the whole idea of the check on the jury system and Mr. Otis's comments about, you know, that the juries get to hear what the defendant wants isn't quite accurate. I mean, first of all, the defendant doesn't have to prove anything. That's in our Constitution. And second of all, the defendant may not have the ability to present the evidence if it hasn't been given to them by the prosecutor because of a discovery violation. One only needs to look at the Stevens case to see that that does exist. And the final point I would say is that if the defense doesn't have the immunity powers that the prosecution has, individuals may not be willing to take the witness stand because their own risk and the own possibility that they might be facing prison time. So it isn't an evenly balanced system as Mr. Otis seems to be proclaiming it is.
Mr. Black?
Go ahead.
I'll pass on this one. I think this is really for people who are more active in the American system as barristers than I am. So I actually am delighted to celebrate some level of agreement with Mr. Otis. I think the allegation that 95% of the statutes involved are unconstitutional is overstating it.
And Mr. Otis, were you going to say more on this point?
Yes, I would. As do Professor Podgor's view, of course it's true that the defendant doesn't need to take the stand or present any evidence. But that is very different from saying that he can't present the evidence he wants. That's just not logical. As to her other point that defendants don't have immunity power, nothing but this. This is not something that's a result of some recent increase in prosecutorial discretion or any recent trend toward overcriminalization. It's been the case for 1,000 years that only the sovereign has the power to immunize. The real problem that exists at trial in getting evidence adduced before the jury is not that the prosecutor has immunity power, as I say, 1,000-year-old power, nothing that's a product of recent statutes or recent trends. The real product is that the defendant's gang, his meth-selling gang, has intimidated or murdered the witnesses, and that's why we have problems, for example, clearing murder cases in the District of Columbia, because drug gangs do not live by the rule of law.
All right. We've got several more callers with questions. Why don't we turn to the next audience member?
Can I just pass? Can you go to the next one?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. We've got three more callers. I'm going to ask the callers to be as succinct as possible with their questions if they could, so we can try and get through all the questions. If you have a question, if you want to get in the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Mr. Black and Professor Podgar if they have views on developments in New York City in particular over the past 10 years, where the police exerted more resources to bringing cases involving petty crimes with the idea that, I'll just call it nipping it in the bud, and I'll take your admonition to keep this short and stop there.
Speaking, since I was named first, Dean, Conrad Black here. Yes, and it is my privilege to know Mr. Brattain, who was, the commissioner who started that, and Mayor Giuliani. And I think it's highly intelligent and effective police procedure. And I want to take this opportunity to assure anyone who might have been put in doubt about this by some of Mr. Otis's comments about what I said, that I would qualify as a charter member of the law and order group of society. I'm not soft on crime. I'm in favor of the rule of law, and I'm in favor of the punishment of criminals. My comments should be taken in that light. And there is no doubt that the techniques that the callers just referred to have been widely emulated in other American cities, and they have been effective. And that sort of thing does reduce crime. Throwing people who drive a truck delivering marijuana in prison for 20 years doesn't reduce crime. Thank you.
Professor Podgor, did you want to weigh in here?
I would just merely say that I think there have been several initiatives that have been on the forefront. One is the Smart on Crime, and the other is Right on Crime. And both of these initiatives are not initiatives that sort of disregard the fact that we need to have a criminal justice system, we need to punish people, we need to sentence people, but that we need to do it with a certain amount of thought process that looks at the total system, that looks at the ability to really have an effect, a deterrent effect, by the actions that were taken.
Professor Otis, do you want to weigh in on this?
I'll just say very briefly that I'm happy to see a second area of agreement with Mr. Black, that I think these measures in New York City are smart, they're effective, and I couldn't agree more that they should remain in place.
Very good. As if by magic, we still have four questions left, so I'm going to continue to ask the callers to be brief with their questions if we could, and we'll try to get to everyone. Hannah, if you could push the button for the next caller to be activated, if you're able to do that. I'm having a computer problem here. I think I announced at the beginning of this call that we're having some power problems here at the Federalist Society. It seems to have
affected. Hi, it's Andy Schlafly. I think I'm on now.
Yes, we can hear you, Andy. Go right ahead.
Yeah, Professor Otis, I take objection to your emphasis on a reduction in crime, overall crime, with all this imprisonment, these massive sentences that are handed out. I mean, if we locked everybody up, we would have zero crime, right? And it's that sort of utilitarian approach to justice that's starting to dominate, particularly in the federal system, where 20-year, 25-year sentences are now handed down routinely for some utilitarian justification rather than a traditional mens rea justification.
That's for you, Professor Otis.
The question is put in general terms and make it difficult to respond to. One would have thought that a utilitarian justification for what goes on in the criminal justice system, that there's nothing wrong with it. What other thing would we look to justify whatever the length of sentences is? And although the caller is correct in saying that sentences now are longer than they were back in the 60s and 70s, there is a reason for that. The reason is that the crime rate spiked in the 60s and 70s, which was the era in which the system and in particular judges emphasized rehabilitation over punishment and incapacitation. When the country saw the amount of crime that it was getting, it wanted to do something about it. What it did about it was introduce, both in federal law and now in many states, sentencing guidelines and more mandatory minimum sentences. They were a response to a problem, and as I pointed out, the problem has been successfully addressed. We now have crime rates that are down to a point that we haven't seen since the 1950s. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. And if it's done in the name of utilitarianism, that is reducing the harm to crime victims, I'm all for it, and I make no apologies for it.
Very good. Bill, Mr. Otis, Professor Otis, Professor Podgor or Mr. Black, do you have anything on this point?
Yes, I would just like to say that I think to anyone who's listening to this, to say that there is less crime out there today because of this massive incarceration, I don't think is really accurate. I mean, just ask anyone on the streets who has a computer if they've had identity theft, if they've had computer fraud problems. Or, these are not crimes that we're going to necessarily see in the statistical logging that you're looking at. And so I think that if we're going to base it upon statistics, then I think we need to look beyond how many people have been charged with the crimes or how many people have actually reported the crimes. Most businesses are not going to report a computer type experience they have that might fit the statute of 18 U.S.C. 1030. So that's just one example of the inaccuracy of the statistical reporting system that you seem to be relying upon.
Mr. Black,
if I could
point?
Respond to that.
Professor Otis.
The statistics that I am using come from the Bureau of Justice Statistics and cover what most normal people would think of as crime, murder, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, various swindles, car theft, that kind of thing. Now, as Professor Podgor says, in the last 20 years, there's been an increase in computer crime. That's because there's been an increase in the use of computers and the kind of the birth of the Internet. So it's quite true that there is a kind of crime that exists now that did not exist 20 or 30 years ago. But that is hardly to gainsay the fact that there has been, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics under administrations of both parties, a massive decrease in the crime rate across the board for what ordinary people correctly think of as crime.
Mr. Black, would you like to weigh in here?
Yeah, I was glad to hear Professor Otis acknowledge that the increasing use of mandatory minimums does, in fact, reduce the applicability of the celebration he made at the beginning of his remarks about how juries convict and judges sentence and it's the rule of law as interpreted and so forth. There has been a shift of power from authority from judges to legislators, and the whole sentencing function of judges has been cramped by having their hands tied, and this business of three strikes and you're out, and this race from left to right in the political spectrum. There's almost no difference between the left and the right in these matters. to be tougher on crime, longer sentences and so forth, to throw away any thought of rehabilitation and focus, as Mr. Professor Otis said, quite rightly, I agree with him on, I mean, I agree that it's happening, on punishment and removal. It is a step backwards. It's very severe. Some of it needed to be done, and I think the bubble in crime that he's referring to was largely because of the greater activity of the feminist movement, making the country more aware of violations of women, and because of the Attica and San Quentin riots and other events, the whole Black Power thing becoming identified in the minds of large sections of the public with the dangers of being soft on crime. But these are very complicated issues, and I just say I knew Jim Wilson quite well, and in his last days he had serious misgivings about the extent to which he, in his own writings, given a blank check to increased incarceration.
Hannah DeGuzman, if you could take us to our next caller, please. And if you're able to, let me know how many questions we have in the queue.
Hello. Thank you, everyone, for the great talk. This is Matthew Rackney from Pace Law School. And as a Canadian studying law here in the States, it's particularly interesting to hear from Mr. Black on his experience. This is just a quick question, picking up on Professor Otis's rebuttal to the critique of the plea bargain system and the extent to which cases are played out. And this sort of picks up on the last caller's utilitarian critique. My question is to the extent that everything is reduced to kind of a transactional risk benefit analysis for the defendant coming into a case, and to the extent that we're, instead of relying on mens rea justifications for convictions and more strict liability justifications, is there not a risk of sort of undermining the system altogether? And here I just want to pick up on something Blackstone said. It's better that 10 guilty persons escape than that one innocent suffer. So to the extent that we're prioritizing efficiency and judicial economy, is there a risk that we may be undermining some of the overarching values which actually underpin the system?
That sounds like a question for Professor Otis.
Although it's general commentary as well.
Okay, I'll just give a very brief answer. I agree with the caller, and I agree and with many others who are now concerned about one particular aspect that seems to be growing in criminal law, which is that there are regulatory, largely environmental crimes that no longer require mens rea. I think that is very worrisome. The traditional system, the common law system, the system that the framers were familiar with, virtually all crime required a bad heart and bad intent. And that's the kind of crime of which there has been so much of a reduction over the last generation. It's also the kind of crime or the kind of behavior that I think properly results in criminal sanctions. It may well be the case that environmental and regulatory offenses that do not require mens rea should encounter some kind of civil penalty, a civil crime, but I have some considerable misgivings about making them criminal offenses, as the caller apparently does.
We are technically out of time. Let me check in with Hannah DeGuzman and see how many questions we have pending. Hannah, are you able to tell?
Yes, we have two more questions in the queue.
Okay, I didn't arrange this in advance, but let me ask our experts if they're able to extend for a couple more minutes or if we need to adjourn. And if we need to adjourn, that's just fine.
I can go on.
It's fine here.
Dean, did you ever meet an appellate lawyer who wanted to stop talking?
And a professor as well. Hannah, let's go to our next caller then.
Yes, Stephen Casey here. My brief question concerns the path that judges are taking on criminal cases. What I've seen, particularly where I am, is that judges in Texas are elected. And sometimes it comes straight from the prosecutor's office. I think that if I were general counsel for, like, Dell Computer and had been elected to be a judge and then Bell was one of the parties in front of me the very next day, I would have a severe conflict of interest. And what I noticed is in the description of the teleform is that I think some of the bias, too, comes in here where a judge is working for the prosecutor's office one day and then judging criminal cases the next. I see that they have a tough time taking their prosecutorial hat off. And I wonder if there's any states that I'll know of that have some sort of cooling off period, or if this is an issue at the federal system as well, where you go from being a United States attorney to being appointed a federal judge and then deciding over criminal cases the very next day on with your client, the United States, right in front of you, and what type of biases we should address in that system, because I think it's ripe for abuse in that regard.
Who wants to take a shot at that?
This is Ellen Podger. I'll say something. I think it's an important distinction. I mean, we have so many different systems within the United States. You have the state system, which is in many cases an elected system. You have the federal system, which is on the other side, which has a life term for judges, which also presents issues and also has benefits, too. So, I mean, no matter what approach is taken, there are going to be some deficiencies there, and I think you point out one of the deficiencies of having a space between people. There's also the case of judicial conflicts, no matter how high up you go. It's a continual problem. So, I mean, I think you point out a very important point, but it's something that can be seen in the state system, not necessarily as much so in the federal system, but that there are different systems here, and that's important to recognize that there are differences.
I would say only one thing about that, which is that existing federal law requires a judge to recuse himself whenever his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. I think that where someone is the United States attorney one day and a district judge the next day, that he could not sit on cases that were pending in the U.S. Attorney's office at the time he was there. Now, down the road, there are going to be cases that came in after he left. And as to those cases, simply the fact that he served in the U.S. Attorney's office would not disqualify him down the road from sitting on a case that he was not involved with. But, of course, if he knows the assistant U.S. attorney who's presenting the case or is a personal friend of his, then it seems to me that his impartiality could reasonably be questioned, and in that instance, the judge ought seriously to consider recusing himself, and I believe most of them would.
Mr. Black, do you want to weigh in?
Well, at a certain point, we have to rely on the integrity of these people, and I don't doubt that the majority of judges are people of integrity, but I do agree most emphatically that too many American judges are ex-prosecutors. There aren't enough private practice lawyers and law professors, academic lawyers, who are on the bench in the U.S., and the percentage of American judges that are prosecutors is much higher than it is in the other countries I'm familiar with, Canada and the United Kingdom. I'm not suggesting prosecutors shouldn't be judges, but they shouldn't be the overwhelmingly preeminent number of first instance judges that they are in the U.S., I think.
Hannah, could you take us to our final question, please?
This is Paul Larkin from the Heritage Foundation. I want to thank the panel for extending their remarks and for being willing to participate in this at all. My question, I'll be very brief. It seems that there is a phenomenon that is occurring on a non-trivial number of instances where there are a large number of felony charges brought against someone, and the case results in a guilty plea to a misdemeanor. Now, it was my experience when I was in the federal system that misdemeanors were basically what comes out of the south end of a northbound chicken, that nobody really liked them, and that they were designed simply to be a justification for the time and effort that everybody put into a case. Jonathan Turley from the GW Law School once said that the Justice Department lives by numbers, and he equated it to the body count approach in Vietnam. Now, I'm not trying to denigrate the need to show that people are effective, but to what extent is the system that we have of rewarding individuals and large-scale agencies based on the number of convictions, a risk or an actual fact in causing the overcriminalization that we have seen. People will require a plea of some type just to justify the time that they've spent on a case.
Professor Otis, do you want to take a first shot at that?
I'm always happy to hear from Paul and enjoyed working with him when we were together many years ago in the Department of Justice. I disagree with the premise of the question. I think the last thing that Paul said, why is it the case that the prosecutor will just settle at the end of the day simply to extract a misdemeanor plea? A prosecutor can't extract anything. The defendant can always say to the prosecutor, you got nothing. Your evidence is what comes out of the south end of a chicken. We're going to trial, and I'm going to make you look like the dope you are. Any defendant can say that, and he will go right to trial. The idea that people go to prison simply because prosecutors whimsically charge them on the basis of nothing, it's just not so. It's just not so. I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office for 18 years, and although Paul talks about what he believes to be an increasing practice of larding on, you know, one felony count after another and then settling for a misdemeanor conviction, I don't recall a single case in my career that was anything like that. When we had a felony charge, if there were going to be a plea bargain, it would be to a felony conviction, although, as I say, the defendant was always completely at liberty to go to trial and make us prove it beyond a reasonable doubt to the satisfaction of a unanimous jury of 12 impartial people. That remains the defendant's constitutional right today, and let them exercise it. That's what the framers had in mind.
Professor Podgor or Mr. Black?
Yes, it's always a pleasure to hear from Paul Larkin, and I do agree with you completely. There is an enormous amount of overcharging in the system. I think that the sentencing guidelines have actually been a benefit in that regard because it's in many instances doesn't increase the sentence because it combines the charges when it's the same conduct involved. But that being the case, it's still the fact that juries tend to compromise, and that's a fact of life, so that if you're presenting that to the jury with so many charges, there might possibly be a compromise situation. To go back to Mr. Otis's comments about the defendant is always at liberty, doesn't, you know, they can always go to trial. It isn't always that case, and that's a sad fact. Many individuals, number one, can't afford to take that risk of going to trial. When you're facing an enormous sentence and the possibility that you might lose your freedom versus you're being offered something that's a very small sentence, even though you may be innocent, it may be worth it because of the risk involved to take the position that you shouldn't go to trial. People with families very often can't take that risk. There's also the possibility that a prosecutor may be threatening a person from that family, that they're going to indict that individual. And do they want that to be, do they want it to extend to that? So I think to say that a person is always has that liberty, I'm not so sure about that. I think that some of the liberties that we'd like to think that we do have aren't quite there in the same form that they ought to be there. So I thank you, Mr. Larkin, for presenting that issue. I think it is a very important issue because we operate in a reactive society right now, and that's unfortunate. If we were more proactive in fighting crime, we'd probably have a better system. But as a reactive society, it's based upon numbers. It's based upon the fact of how many convictions you can get if you want to get your future funding. This is something you have to look at, and that's unfortunate.
Mr. Black, any thoughts on this point?
Yeah, well, I agree with Mr. Larkin and Professor Podgor. They throw all the spaghetti at the wall. You get a tremendous number of counts, and the more counts, the more confusing it is for the jurors, and the more likely it is that you're going to get the jury room responding to the argument, well, our government is saying these people are guilty, and we've got to give them something. And there's no doubt that is a factor in a lot of convictions. The extent to which this gets into misdemeanors is a matter that I'm not really qualified to comment on. But I go back to my earlier statement. The percentage of prosecutions that lead to convictions in the United States is 99.5%, and the prosecutors are not right 99.5% of the time. Since they do, in practice, have an absolute immunity, it is absolutely obvious to any reasonably experienced person who knows anything about human nature that there's going to be a terrible amount of abuse, and that's what happens. I must tell you, Mr. Otis, that in your prison system, I met perhaps 1,000 people, and some of them were quite dodgy people. Many were sort of Damon Runyon hoods, you know, and that sort of thing. Most of them, I wasn't in places where there were a lot of violent people, but many of them were really kind of likable rogues, but scoundrels. But nobody, absolutely nobody I met, had lower ethics than the members of the U.S. Prosecution Service that we encountered. They lied again and again. We caught them lying again and again, and there was never any sanction for it at all. The judge never reprimanded them. As I said at the outset, you people have a real problem, and I've left the country now. It's not my problem anymore.
Very good. Well, sort of in recognition of the fact that Professor Otis was outnumbered here, I'm going to give him the final word, and then we'll wrap up. Professor Otis,
okay.
You want to take a minute?
Thank you, Dean. There are two points that I want to make in response. One is that I've heard that prosecutors, U.S. attorneys' offices get funding based on the number of convictions. I think that's just flat out false. I was in the U.S. Attorney's office for 18 years. I never heard of any such thing, and I would like to see what the specific evidence and documentation for that is, because I don't think there is any. The second thing that I want to address is the reason defendants wind up pleading guilty so much of the time. And the suggestion has been made that it's basically a process of extortion, that they're threatened with this and they're threatened with that, but the this and that never actually get mentioned. But I will mention what the this and that are. The thing that persuades defendants to plead guilty is the evidence. That's the thing that's never getting mentioned in this teleforum. When the government, as I said in my very opening remark, the reason people plead guilty is that they are guilty. You just said the idea that we have, you know, one defendant after another marching up to the podium of the court and telling the court under oath at the plea-taking proceeding and with the assistance of counsel that they're guilty of something they didn't do is something that could be maintained only by a person who has no very long experience in actual trials and in presenting a case in court. People do not plead guilty to stuff they don't do. There may be rare isolated cases in which that happens, of course, because there are rare isolated exceptions to everything in life. The real reason people plead guilty is that they did it, the government has the evidence, and they're going to get credit with the judge for accepting responsibility for what they did by pleading guilty rather than having the whole thing spelled out in a trial that they know they're going to lose.
We will let that be the final word for today. And with that, I want to sincerely thank our experts today, Mr. Conrad Black, Professor Bill Otis, and Professor Ellen Podgore. You've more than met your commitment, so I certainly appreciate it. To our audience, I invite you again to join us for our next teleforum conference call scheduled for Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number when we'll be debating gun control and its legal and policy implications. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.